They were wearing their usual space coveralls, made of some loose, pliant material quite unknown to me, but fastened tightly at the wrists and ankles and with a wide flat belt around the waist. One both were bare-headed, but even in the half-light I could see the gleam of their golden, blonde hair, Frank's cut short and Frances falling in soft waves to her shoulders. They made a handsome, well-built couple, Frank standing about 6 feet in height and his beautiful companion about 5 feet 8 inches. They came forward to meet me with a warm embrace as we exchanged mutual greetings. Then Frank said, "Come, let us go into your house. We wish to talk to you." Frank's first message to me was a purely personal one. There was a grave problem in my life regarding the health and well-being of a dear friend, which had been causing me deep concern. To my great surprise, my space friends knew every detail of my problem and were quick in extending sympathetic understanding and helpful advice, which brought great comfort. He then discussed with me some special plans for building a new workshop further north, near Forestville, Quebec, in which I was to carry out further scientific work on the Tesla ideas. Then Frances stepped forward, a beautiful smile on her lovely face. "And now, Arthur," she said, "I will give you, without the interference experienced or the Tesla scope, my meditations on the good life, a gift to the people of Earth, with love and prayer for you all, in my heart." She paused, as we settled comfortably in my living room to listen to her words, then with a silvery ripple of soft laughter she commenced. "My first message is of such simplicity that many of you will no doubt laugh, but this is exactly what I want you to do, for my words concern the great value of a smile in all human relationships. In short, I want to talk to you tonight about pleasantness of disposition. My friends, you must never underrate the inestimable power for good in a pleasant manner towards all creatures, circumstances and life in general. A charming smile, a pleasant word or two, will instantly dispel the anger or hard feelings of those ill-disposed towards you, for a genuine smile is a positive radiation of light in which the shadow of negativity cannot exist. We cannot emphasize strongly enough the vital importance of a pleasant disposition, for it is the golden key to a happy, healthy life. Did you know that if you cultivate a pleasant disposition, if you smile and laugh a lot, your physical body can not be assailed by many diseases which are caused by purely mental depression and unnatural anxiety? This is the divine law, my friend, and if you desire the two greatest blessings of life, health and happiness, they can be yours by means of the Christ rule, which is the simple act of being pleasant both to yourself and to all others. It is even the secret of acquiring peace on your earth. Does not your Bible speak of peace on earth and goodwill towards men of goodwill? This, of course, is nothing new to you. You have been told about it many times, in many ways, by many people. Why is it then that the people of earth cannot learn so simple a lesson with such happy results? As we look down upon you, we see so many of you going about your daily lives with grim expressions on your faces. Some of you will immediately say that life on earth is grim, but, dear ones, can't you realize that you are only adding to its grimness by this negative attitude? If you want brighter conditions on earth, all of you have it in your power to bring about this happier state of affairs by development of a cheerful outlook, a pleasant manner and a glowing smile. It is so simple as that. Surely, you know that a smile is the most contagious thing on earth. Give one and it will be multiplied many times. Some of you may ask, what exactly is pleasantness? It is a precious jewel indeed, for pleasantness is a many-faceted diamond, with many forms of expression. In essence, it is the simple act of extending goodwill to yourself and to others and particularly those who may hate you, for you see, it is also a form of self-protection because the light you thus emanate cannot be penetrated by the forces of darkness. A pleasant personality entails an optimistic outlook of life, always looking for the good and beautiful which exists everywhere as your Bible says, "Seek, and ye shall find." Pleasantness should be reflected in your every thought, word and deed. It will add an irresistible charm to your personality, bringing in a joy to yourself and happiness to others. Since pleasantness is such an attractive quality, why is it that Earth people in general do not include it among the avowedly important elements of character building? We watch, with great admiration, many of you teaching your children to be honest, truthful and unselfish, but is not pleasantness the highest form of unselfishness? Of course, it is, for it is a positive outpouring of goodwill, which brings joy to others and immediately puts them at ease, and furthermore, it brings the reciprocal reward of returned pleasantness. In short, it makes everyone happy. How then can the people of Earth, weighed down by fears and anxieties, develop this gracious art of pleasantness? Well, to break the acquired habits of many years, brought about by the incomplete understanding of the true meaning of life, is not, I realize, an easy task. So may I, with love in my heart, suggest a few steps to develop a pleasant personality and urge those of you who are parents or teachers to pass on this invaluable knowledge to your little children. 1. Practice the art of smiling sincerely, not pretending, at work, at play and particularly in your contacts with others. Be generous with your smiles. They cost you nothing but a slight movement of your facial muscles, and you will be amazed at what you receive in return. 2. When you talk to others, smile at them and make pleasant remarks. Never miss an opportunity to pass on a genuine compliment. This is valuable therapeutic psychology, for it not only gives pleasure but encourages the recipient to live up to the compliment. 3. To be easy to get on with is the description of a notable characteristic. To please, it is not necessary to have youth or beauty, or even manners. Charm is something in voice or expression which makes you feel better, disposed to your ease to look at or listen to. We need not care whether pleasant people are highly educated, they do something far greater, they practically demonstrate the great theorem of the livableness of life. 4. How many well-meaning folk need warning, to not let their good be evil spoken of and your principles discredited because the religion you profess seem, in your practice of it, unlivable, unlovable. You wish people to read something of faithful character in your example, take care that they do not take you for a hypocrite. 5. To induce an admiring love for what is good by your conduct, is an aim you will never reach if you are unpleasant, ungracious, unkind. Remember what Christ said, "Judge not, forgive men, give to him that asketh of thee, blessed are the peacemakers. Do good to them that hate you." And now, Arthur, our dear friend, let me read a little verse which we of Venus learn. Although it takes so many months to make a single year, yet far more quickly than you think, the months will disappear, the very centuries have wings, new years grow old and gray, the work which you intend to do, begin it, friend, today. Chapter 5, Part 2. So many months, so many weeks, but soon they will be past. There is but one short life to live. Each year may be the last. To yesterday there is no door, to tomorrow may not be. Today is yours, but nothing more belongs to you or me. Within a single fleeting hour, how many minutes lie? But, even as you wait to count, will 60 moments fly? If you've a tender word to say, a kindly deed to do, suppose you do it just this day? I would, if I were you. Thanks for the good advice, I said, I will do my best, but there are many questions which I would like you to answer. Time goes fast, who would believe it is almost 8 years since you were last here? Have you time to answer one question? Frank smiled and nodded, we will stay a short time, he said, but I must warn you that if the sky brightens, we will have to take off immediately. But speak on, I will try to answer your question. Well, Frank, I asked, can you tell me something about this thing which we on Earth call gravity? Can we ever hope to free ourselves from it? Frank's deep blue eyes scanned mine searchingly. An intriguing question, he replied. One thing I know, and which I am sure you know also, is the fact, and all else is only theory, that gravity is a name used for the unknown force that draws all things towards a center of attraction. It is a divine law, and as with all divine law, it is forever. But, what exactly do you mean by freedom from gravity? Do you mean no gravity at all, or an easy means of lifting yourselves from Earth? We of Venus have that power by means of applied thought or faith, but we do not remove or interfere, or try to interfere, with the natural force of gravity. Let me explain a little more about gravity. Nothing new in what I can tell you. I think you have as much information about the subject as we have. But as you ask me, I will tell you all that we of Venus know. Gravity consists of two distinct parts: centrifugal force due to a planet's rotation, plus the force of natural attraction of the planet. 2. If the attractive force of planet Earth could be stopped, or counteracted, and the centrifugal force remained, all loose material on Earth, including air, water, and most buildings, would leave Earth forever and fly off into space. If the centrifugal force should also be stopped or counteracted and gravity made equivalent to zero, physical bodies would have no weight. The pressure that the upper strata of Earth's atmosphere exerts on the lower strata would cease to exist. The gaseous air would expand and leave the Earth, followed by the water which would vaporize. The moon, held in its orbit by the attraction of the Earth, would leave it, and many other drastic changes would occur. If conditions changed so that the human body was no longer subject to gravity, the change would prove fatal, for your physiological and psychological processes would be so deranged you would quickly die under the new conditions. Such conditions imply that the air, water and food which enter the body changed from a condition in which they had weight to one in which they did not. Much more could be said, but it would all amount to the same thing. Gravity is one of God's natural laws. It is an exact law and therefore perfect, and if man could upset it, he could not exist. Man cannot improve God's law, but we can make use of them. I believe thought to be the greatest power in existence, and it is by the use of this power that we can overcome the force of gravity. Earthmen could learn to use this power, by the practice of perfect faith, not blind faith, by the irrefutable belief that it can be done. God be with you, our friend, and with us always, as we work together for spiritual progress and peace on Earth. With the ending of those words, Frank and Francis stepped into the X-12. The door closed behind them. Seconds later, the great spacecraft rose silently and was soon lost behind the clouds, leaving me with many questions in my mind and wondering when they would return. Chapter 6. In early August, 1969, I started off by car for a trip out to Western Canada. Everything went well until I came near to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. There I met with an accident on the road. This occurred on a gravelly stretch of new construction, when without any warning and in a restricted speed zone, a car shot by at a very high speed, sending up a shower of stones which smashed my car window, sending a piece of broken glass into my left eye, and a slight cut on my left hand, so that I could not continue. I tried to have repairs made at a number of service stations, but they all had the same excuse: no glass on hand to fit, and it would require at least 4 days to obtain some. I decided to return to Quebec City, so I patched up the window with clear plastic and headed home via Highways 17 and 69. Then on 401. Lucky we had no rain, so I took my time stopping at Brockville, Ontario, for 2 nights, and during the time I was there, I received a message from a friend who was posted at the army camp at Gagetown, N.B. He said that a large spaceship had been seen by hundreds of army personnel and he wanted me to go there just as soon as possible. I left Brockville at 4 a.m. and arrived at Quebec City around noon, where a service station applied a new window to my car, which required a little more than 1 hour. I then drove home to Lakeport, which is about 16 miles from the station where they fixed the window. By the time I fixed up a light lunch and had a wash, it was almost 3 p.m. I then headed for uptown Quebec City, over the old Quebec Bridge, and then along the number 2 highway, east, Gagetown, here we come. But it was much too far to reach that night. I arrived at Notre Dame du Lac around 8 p.m. where I stayed for the night. I left after breakfast at 6 a.m. and arrived at Gage Town at 11, and as it was a nice day, I enjoyed a picnic lunch before looking for my friend, whom I located around 12:30. We then went to the place where the spaceship was seen and I made a very careful inspection, using the special detectors designed by Tesla. One, I also extended my investigation by questioning the local residents and army personnel who say they saw the large spacecraft land. Two, all their descriptions tallied perfectly with that of the X-12. On my return home a few days later, I set up the Tesla scope, which I had dismantled for my expected long trip out west. It was towards the end of August, 1969, that I received a message from Frank via the Tesla scope. It was a request, and it concerned a very earthbound matter. During their visit to me on April 15, 1969, while in my house, Frank had read a news item, which appeared in a UFO paper, which was published in Vancouver, BC. The story concerned a large piece of metal, which was said to have been picked up near Quebec City in 1960.3. The person who wrote the story said it was a mystery because no one had been able to find out exactly what it was, and the writer went on to say that members of a Canadian science club thought that it might have fallen from space. They said it weighed about 3,000 pounds. Frank was interested because of the statement he read, which said the metal might be of extraterrestrial origin, and as this could be interesting, he wanted me to make some tests on it with him. Frank then gave me instructions on how to make the tests, using a Tesla bridge and a tape recorder. The piece of metal was at Ottawa, Ontario, where, as per the instructions, which I received from Frank, I made a very careful test. In fact, I made three complete tests, with a number of persons present, by means of the Tesla bridge. I was able to transmit the information recorded over the Tesla scope directly to Frank, who then made a careful analysis, and according to his findings, it compared exactly with some other pieces of iron which were a part of the first Quebec bridge which fell in 1906. When I asked Frank if he could give me an idea of the actual composition and percentage of the various metals found in the chunk, he said that knowing the actual percentage of the various metals would prove nothing, and would be a waste of his time, for our test proved beyond any doubt that it had never been in space. It is exactly the same composition as other blocks found in the same location. Chapter 7, Christmas Eve, 1969. I had just arrived from Montreal where by the grace of God my problem had been solved. As promised by our two Venusian friends, Frank and Francis, I had driven from Valmorin, which is 45 miles north of Montreal, a very good road in fine weather, but I had a blinding snowstorm for most of the 45 miles, with slow orders all the way. Lucky for me, the balance of the 212-mile journey was fine and clear all the way to Quebec. I was a bit tired when I arrived home, and decided to rest before unloading my car, but no sooner lay down to rest when the alarm on the Tesla scope sounded. Of all things, I thought, a Christmas message? It was the voice of Frank. "We are landing," he said, "come right away." As there was not much snow in the fields, it did not take me long to run down to where the great X-12 had landed, in the same old spot. Frank and Francis were standing in the doorway, all smiles. "Christmas greetings, old man," said Frank. "Come in, we have a surprise for you." "What do you mean, surprise?" I said. "Is not your unexpected visit surprise enough?" "Well," said Frank, "we have a greater surprise. Come with us." So I followed them up to the top level of the great space ship, which by means of the wonderful thought-operated lift took only a few seconds, and there we were, almost 300 feet high. "Take a look, Arthur," said Frank, pointing to a large silver ball. "What is it?" I asked. "Looks like an overgrown football, a silver ball." Frank laughed, and replied, "That football, as you call it, my good friend, is a time machine." "No kidding," I said. "No," replied Frank, "I am not kidding, that is a real time machine. Would you like to go places in it? Back or forward into the past or future history of your world?" I was amazed, and only partly convinced. I had read many stories of time machines, very interesting but none of them true. But up to now I had no reason to doubt the word of Frank, and from beholding the wonders which I had seen on Venus, and the fact of this great spaceship operated by thought alone, I knew that unless Frank was just pulling my leg, the time machine was another wonder of Venus. I said as much to Frank.
Okay, said Frank, tell me, where do you wish to go?
I would like to see what our world will be like 2,000 years from now, I said. For instance, what will my property look like? Will it remain a nice country place? I have ideas of what the world is rushing into, so if your time machine really works, let's go. Without further remark, Frank opened a small door in the side of the great silver ball.
Are you ready?
Asked Frank.
I am almost scared to death, I replied.
Both Frank and Francis laughed at my amazed face.
No danger, they both assured me.
Just tell us where you would like to go. That is, have you made up your mind? Do you wish to go forward, or go back into history?
To what year exactly, and exactly where on Earth?
Well, I said, if you are not pulling my leg, I would like to see my property, this exact spot, on the 24th day of December, 2,000 years ahead from now.
Okay, said Frank, go inside, sit down, and do not rove at any time, remain in the exact same spot.
But if you feel yourself to be in danger, or for whatever reason you wish to return, call out, or as you say on Earth, yell. We will bring you back just as soon as we hear your words. I sat down, and Frank closed the door, leaving me in almost total darkness. Then a slight buzzing started. After what appeared hours, but really it was only a few moments, I found myself seated alone, and after a few seconds for my eyes to get used to the bright light, I noticed there was no snow, and the thing which I noticed most was the very warm temperature. In fact, it was hot. But, I thought, how could this be? For when I had walked to the spaceship on the 24th day of December 1969, it was about 25 below zero at Lakeport, not much snow, but we did have a couple of inches. Now here was I in exactly the same spot, with no spaceship in sight, seated on a block of stone, outside in the open. Yes, it was hot. But, I thought, if this time machine is a fact, this was the year 3969. The world had passed through 2,000 years, and what a change! That which had been a tree-covered mountain in 1969, was completely covered with ruins. No sign of any buildings, only ruins, block piled on block, no trees at all. Was I dreaming? Was the silver ball time machine a fact? What caused this ruin? Many questions passed through my mind. Large stone blocks, crumbling ruins, reminded me of pictures I had seen of the ruins of old Rome. Some day in the past, great stone buildings had been built on what had been my farm property. What caused their destruction? As far as the eye could see, complete total destruction. Where was the once beautiful country gone? I sat there with sadness in my heart. There did not appear to be any life, no birds, or any little wild friends, who once used to come to meet me when I walked down into the woods. The ruins appeared completely dead, as far and in every direction the eye could see, nothing but ruins. I appeared to be free of the silver ball, as I saw no sign of it. I was sitting on one of the stone blocks, and I could see in all directions. I did not dare to move because Frank had warned me not to, so I remained in the one spot. No life, did I say? What on earth is that? Did my eyes play tricks? For the coming out from a space between large stone blocks was a queer-looking monster. It appeared to be about 50 feet long, with a large head, and all the appearance of a large lizard. It saw me and started to approach. It came within 100 feet and sat up. It looked funny, but I did not laugh. I wondered, should I yell and let Frank bring me back to 1969, or should I wait to see if the monster came nearer? I also wondered, who was more scared,
Me or the monster? No doubt it had never seen a human creature before. Well, it did not appear interested in me, for he, or she, soon got tired of watching me, and got down on all 4 feet, and started to eat some weeds growing between the stones. All this time I had been wondering if the people who had built this place had left any records, and if so, how could I discover them? This was a problem because Frank had warned me not to leave my seat. I could see many stones of all shapes and sizes. Perhaps someone had cut some form or kind of record into one or more of the stones, such as we do with a cornerstone, but unless I could move from my seat, it would be impossible to find any record. There did not appear to be anything which I could do until I returned to the year 1969, and perhaps, interest Frank to return with me so that we could search for records. I was thinking along that line when I saw the creature, whatever it was, run back into the space between the stones. Something had scared it, but at first I saw nothing except the rocks. Then I looked up as I noticed the creature was doing, and in amazement I saw something was gliding down from the sky. Nearer and nearer it came. Slowly it came and grew larger and larger until it almost covered the sky. A spaceship, I cried in amazement. Yes, indeed, but what a spaceship. It appeared to be at least 4 times the size of the X-12. At first, I felt like running, but something told me to remain where I was. At last, the giant ship came to rest. The control tower, made exactly like the X-12, was roughly 250 feet in diameter, and I figured it would be 900 feet high. The body of the ship covered everything in sight. It was roughly 2,400 feet in diameter. As I sat there, almost frozen with fear, the door opened. Can you guess who came out? Yes, with a boyish grin, it was Frank, not looking a day older than when I had left him 2,000 years ago. Laughing at my surprised look, he asked, "Why are you surprised? Did I not tell you that we of Venus live for thousands of years?" "Yes," I replied, "you did, but I am hard to convince. Is Francis with you?" "Yes, right here," said the silver voice of our beautiful friend as she came to the door, also not looking a day older. They both care and sat on the stone blocks with me. "Well, Arthur," said Frank, "have you seen enough of the future?" "Yes and no, Frank," I replied. "I have a few questions. First, how can I search these ruins? I would like to find, if possible, some record perhaps cut into the stones. Try to find out what caused this ruin. Can I leave this seat or will you tell me the answer to this problem?" Frank looked thoughtful. "It is impossible for you to leave your seat, even for a moment without danger. But I will search for you," he said. He then walked towards a large group of stones, and started to search, moving from stone to stone, and writing on a pad, which he carried. It appeared to be hours before he returned with a smile on his face. "You found something?" I asked. "Yes," replied Frank, "I found something. Not a complete record, I fear, but we have the sad story." "Sad?" I questioned. "Just how sad?" "Well," said Frank, "I will try to give you a good picture of the past 2,000 years, according to that which I know personally, and from the records cut into these stones. It was during the late 1970s, between 1971 and 1978, that an atomic war broke out between China and Russia. One, this led to the Third World War. America, Canada, England, and South America included. In the end, no one won, as could be expected. Most of the known world was almost completely destroyed. Only a few persons who lived in the hills and close to the North and South Poles managed to keep alive. The whole nature of Earth changed, the very seasons altered. The only people left were those of the hills of China, good people who had little use or need of those things which most of the Western world depended on for their existence. It was, according to the records cut in the stones, in 1983 that the people of China moved to Canada, and the ruins, which you see before you, are a part of their development, which continued until the year 2920. In other words,
the Chinese people owned most of the world at that time. Then without warning, the end came. One moment the people were doing everything they liked to do and worshipping the sun, God. The next moment, all was destroyed, the sun, God could not save them. As we read in the book of Revelation, there is but one God. Frank continued, the world of 2920 thought they were above God. They had invented a super system, as they thought, to maintain their material lives forever.